Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. If you want to feel like a complete slacker, then listen to the following interview. Noah Sanwood Friedman is still in his 20s, but he's the co-founder of a venture fund called Top Shelf Ventures, which specifically invests in the alcohol space. He's also the co-founder of Uncharted Community, a business development lab for high-level founders. And that's just the start of the things that he's done. In this interview, we talked about money and investing and, critically, why he's so positive about the future of alcohol. As always, if you want to know more, sign up to the Drinks Insider newsletter, which you'll find at drinksinsider.com. Hi, Noah. Great to see you.
Super good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you've spoken about how you were thrust into the world of alcohol at 22 or 23. It's a very complicated world in the United States. How did you navigate your way around learning about it and the regulatory system?
Yeah, I fell into the alcohol industry, as you mentioned. The short version of that story is that I started my career with who is now a massive mentor and partner and friend of mine, Michael Loeb. And he was incubating and funding a business that was intending to and rather successfully became an analytics business in the independent retail channel of the alcohol sector, meaning mom and pop retailers across the U.S., I knew very little about the alcohol industry other than what I'd read in the news and being an avid consumer of business news and information, but I had to learn it very quickly.
Oh, I thought you were going to say an avid consumer of alcohol, but no, you are an avid consumer of information.
Avid may be generous. I mean, I had some fun in college, but you know the deal. Avid may be an overstatement.
No, sorry, I cut you off. So you're an avid consumer of information and...
Avid consumer of business, just a business nerd, honestly. But I learned the trade quickly, largely just by diving into it, running and building a team that was selling to independent retailers, interfacing with distributors, and then selling data products to manufacturers and distributors. You have to learn rather quickly both the nuances of the industry, how it works structurally, and most importantly, just what the rhythms are of the space. Mm-hmm. I was fortunate to have a number of very close mentors and friends in the industry that took me under their wing. One in particular is one of the largest retailers on the East Coast who has become basically family at this point. And I'm super grateful to him for early on, as I was reading and consuming all the information I could online and also obviously just in the day-to-day of running this analytics business, learning a lot, having a lot of questions. He would rather consistently bring me up to his stores in the Northeast, either walk me through the stores, sit me in on meetings, and just brain dump information to me along the way so that I could pick up not only the things that you learn, like anybody who's learned anything on a deep level, you know that you can learn a lot by reading, you learn a lot more by doing. And having somebody on the inside who's grown up multi-generations in the space who can not only teach you and tell you, but coach you through what it all really means was massively, massively impactful to me.
And who was that, can I ask?
Yeah, of course. He runs one of the largest retail chains on the East Coast. It's the BevMax chain. Okay. His name is Mike Burkoff. I call him Uncle Mike. And he remains to this day a very close friend and advisor and thought partner, amongst many other things, to me and all the business I have in the alcohol industry. So I'm super grateful to him. But the long and short of it is I learned by diving in deep and having a number of amazing mentors in the space who coached me along the way.
So one of the things that you said in a previous interview is when you were looking at this data, that sometimes you would watch people who raised money and then their brands would blow up. Do you know what they were doing to make that happen?
I think in any venture ecosystem, it is much easier to look in hindsight at what mm-hmm. worked than it is to know in the moment what's working. There are, in any industry, whether it's AI, crypto, CPG, non-alc, meaning the sodas of the world, to alcohol and beyond, there are lots of businesses that start largely attacking the same problem. And what usually ends up working is often much easier to understand in hindsight than it is in foresight. The common thread in booze tends to be a mix of, obviously, you have an amazing product, the liquid tastes good, you have a great package. I think the nuanced thing that really matters most is you have an incredible team who executes relentlessly a playbook that's all aimed at finding efficiencies in the system, right? The way to longevity in the alcohol space and CPG in general, in my opinion, largely stems from your ability to find efficiencies in how you get to market and how you keep customers buying your product, right? The measures of that tend to be velocity and retention. And so the things that I was seeing that was indicating that these brands were going to blow up early was generally how quickly they were moving through their channels, right? Because if the product is moving quickly through a channel, it's indicative of the fact that customers love the product and want to continue to buy it. And if you have that core metric, if you have that core function of the business where you are moving quickly, it's selling quickly, you can find efficiencies in the business that allow you to scale without having to throw gobs and gobs of money inefficiently into an engine that doesn't work that well.
Can you give me an example of what kind of inefficiencies you might be talking about?
A classic inefficiency in the booze business is having a product that sits on shelves without moving too quickly, and you don't have a good mechanism to make sure that it's going to move quick enough to support how much money you have to spend to keep it there, right? Building a company that's a physical product, right? This is a sparkling water, but let's just say there's a booze business. You have to make the product, you have to manufacture it, you have to co-pack it or own it yourself. You have to have the team who can get it to the distributor who then gets it to the to the retailer. You have to support that product at retail. You have to do marketing, you have to do sales, tastings, distributor incentives, the whole nine yards. And the way that that math starts to work is that the thing actually sells at retail, right? We have to remember the customer is the king or queen here. So if they're not actually buying the product at retail or online, everything else is really just inefficiently working towards a metric that's not pulling through. Meaning the inefficiency would be you have the product on shelves at retail, you're able to spend the money to get it there, but it's not selling that quickly. People aren't actually buying it that quickly, which means you're spending a whole bunch of money to run the business that's all aimed at getting a customer to pull the product off the shelf. And they're just not pulling it off. So you're spending money on overhead, you're spending money to make the thing, you're spending money to market it online or try to get top of funnel awareness through brands. If customers aren't buying the thing from the retailers aren't going to reorder, which means the distributors are going to reorder from you, which means you're going to have this pretty big inefficiency between who's buying the product at the end state and drinking it versus you yourself as the brand that's making it. And the best brands in the world are relentless at how they find efficiencies to get to scale to make sure that that engine continues to work well.
Okay. And so you're talking about retail. How did you learn about the off trade, like serving wine in places like bars and so on? And how is that different in terms of the efficiencies you're talking about?
Yeah, the on-premise wine business, i.e. super high-end fine wine, sommeliers, wine lists, that is admittedly probably the area of the alcohol industry I know the least about. I am probably from a personal consumption perspective, the most excited and interested in that, but that's not where we tend to invest. So I will be totally forthright that that is probably the lowest on the totem pole of what I'm qualified to speak about. I understand from a spirits perspective and a beer perspective what it takes to move there.
Okay, well from a spirits perspective, are the same, what approaches do you need differently for the on-trade than the off-trade?
The biggest issue that I think a lot of brands face or the mistake they make when they're looking at on-premise is that they're focused on getting the accounts and not how quickly the accounts are reordering. So the kind of easy way to think about this is there is a very big difference between having, let's just say, a mezcal. There's a very big difference between having a mezcal that is on the back bar and very nicely displayed for people at the bar to see versus that mezcal being on the listed cocktail list where consumers are consistently ordering a drink where that mezcal is going to be poured. If it's on the cocktail list, you have some level of built-in efficiency because by design, when a customer comes in and orders a mezcal Negroni or a mezcal Old Fashioned or a mezcal Paloma or whatever the house cocktail is, the bartender is going to use that brand to pour it in and they're going to move volume, which is going to create velocity. Versus it being on the shelf and on the bar, that's nice and it's cool because you can see it and you can point to it and it's very exciting, but it doesn't really translate necessarily to sales. And the biggest issue, back to what I was saying before, if it just sits there on the back bar and there's no either incentive or awareness or reason for the customer to say, I would like that mezcal, chances are it's not going to move that quickly. And it's a hard game to play, but generally where you win is you have enough brand awareness or ambassadors in the customer sphere, or most importantly, you're on a cocktail list where people actually want to buy it and want to pour your brand into their drink.
Okay, let's go back a step. Top Shelf Ventures. This is a space where it can be very hard to raise money because a lot of, especially in Europe, most funds won't invest in what they call vice stocks. Right. So how did you get into it? How did you raise the money? Tell me the story.
How did I get into it? I saw what you just described as a big opportunity. Mm-hmm. The alcohol industry is massive. It can be remarkably lucrative. It is, you know, had 50 years of straight growth, which is very rare for any American industry where it's continuing to grow every single year until really the years after COVID when there's been a bit of a reset. And more importantly, I was seeing that these brands, as I mentioned earlier, that were starting, they were having success out of the gates in being competitive and having good fundamental businesses where customers were buying it and they were pulling through. And unlike the tech ecosystem or crypto or AI or even climate or lots of other ecosystems that have very active startup environments where there are dozens, if not hundreds of funds that are available to at the very least be pitched for capital that can say, hey, I'm a startup. I have a great business. Here's my idea. If everything works, I'm going to get acquired for $1 billion, right? That happens all the time in alcohol, right? There are $1 billion acquisitions fairly common and frequently in alcohol, and certainly nine-figure acquisitions all the time. And yet, as I saw it a few years ago, the brand that had a real chance to do that because they were out competing, outselling big companies at the earliest stages, they didn't have dedicated places to go for smart money in the space. I would ask a lot of these successful brands, where did you go to raise money? Brands that are now worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And the answer was always, there was no good answer. They were raising friends and family rounds. They were trying to convince a consumer fund who doesn't touch alcohol to be their sort of token vice investment. It was a lot of headwinds that I thought were unnecessary. So I saw an opportunity to come in and try to build the blue chip fund in the space to say, we're going to look at everything. We're going to see everything. We're going to have connectivity to the ecosystem. We're going to try to price rounds effectively and be a dedicated source of smart, accelerating money for the best brands in the space and best opportunities in the broader space that have a chance to one day be worth $1 billion, if you will.
Okay. So where did you get the money from? That's a huge thing to go off and start a fund. How does it work? You know,
it is a huge thing to go off. Yeah. I think any VC will tell you that Fund One is a uniquely challenging, somewhat painful process. The short answer is that we worked our butts off and hustled and knocked on a lot of doors and continued to relentlessly try to build the funnel and pipeline, tell a story, and eventually chipped away to raise a first fund and get our first set of commitments, which then grew. And that gave us enough to get off the ground.
When was this?
We started raising money in earnest around early 2022. That was when we really started to hit the pavement.
So and raise around money. August became one of the worst times in the last, you know, however long to raise money. And yet you did it.
Yeah.
So what arguments did you, I mean, we so did. So it was a really difficult environment and you're in booze, which a lot of people are a bit wary of. What arguments did you use to unlock the money?
Well, the short answer is it was remarkably hard. It was insanely, and the tougher part, honestly, was that a year and a half prior, it was really easy to raise money. And a lot of people raised funds that maybe shouldn't have had funds, but that's a conversation for a different day. So it was very, very hard. What arguments do we make? I told the story that was similar to the one I just told you, right? It was booze is a very big ecosystem. There are venture-like returns available in the space. There are not really any dedicated blue chip funds that have the leverage not only to find the best deals, but to price them effectively and to bring other capital in with them. Jason, my partner, and I had backgrounds that we felt were credible. And, you know, we put together a good pitch that rhymed with, here's how we're going to go carve out a really meaningful position in this space that's going to not only be a good vehicle to hopefully return capital to investors over time, but also have a big influence on the industry. And, you know, we had to tell that story a lot of times. We got a lot of no's, but eventually we got some yeses and I think they're pretty happy that they said yes.
Okay. So now you've got your money and you're ready to go. How many brands did you look at and what made you decide this one, not that one?
We looked at hundreds and hundreds of brands. The first deal we ever did was in November of 2022. It was a company called Grazzi, which has been one of our best performing companies. It's in the wine space.
Is that a box? Is that a boxed wine?
Boxed wine, exactly. We looked at hundreds and continued to. I mean, we've just started investing out of our second fund in the last couple of weeks. And so we still see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of brands. And we try to say with confidence that we see every brand in the ecosystem, whether or not they're raising money, at least have an eye on them. So we look at a lot. We look at a lot. And before we make an investment, we really benchmark.
So last year, I interviewed the head of Distill Ventures, and she said that she went to a lot of bars and she just went and she watched what people were drinking. And that was part of the discovery process. What's your discovery process? Do you spend a lot of time in bars or do people come to you?
A bit of both. We have three sources of deal flow. The first is that we've built a fairly comprehensive AI and manual powered web scraper that basically is looking across the internet at any given moment on any site that sells alcohol online, any news article that's talking about alcohol, any product announcement, social media, to basically categorize and benchmark any type of new product in whatever industry and subcategory it's in. That's part one.
Hang on. That is so interesting. I just want to follow that up. How do you benchmark it? Because I presume you're not seeing the sales figures for that. I mean, how do you know whether something's working or not?
So the first version is we don't know whether or not it's working. We have some sort of initial quantitative metrics around digital traffic and social media followers and some other stuff we've been able to uncover. But the first version is just, you know, we narrow it down based on our scope of what's fundable. Generally, things that are owned by big behemoths already or super big are probably not in scope just because they're likely too big. So we're looking at a mix of how new is this product? How long has it been on market? And then we usually have teams or ourselves will reach out and have initial conversations with lots of different companies to try to get a sense of where they are on the funnel.
Okay, so I interrupted you. You said there were three approaches. That's number one. What are the others?
Yeah. Number two is we have an amazing advisory network of people across the industry who we consider part of the top shelf team, who their mandate, I mean, they're not full-time employees by any mean, but their mandate is to go around at any time they see something interesting, let us know. Right. So that has worked remarkably well to just have a consistent flow of qualified inbound of new opportunities in the space coming our way from people that we trust. And the third, which has continued to compound now that the top shelf name has gotten out there a bit more. We haven't done a public unveiling of the fund, but we've put ourselves out there a little bit on social media and I'm fairly active. We have a remarkable amount of inbound where people hear about Top Shelf Ventures. They go to our website, they see our hello at topshelf.ventures and just send us a note or find me on LinkedIn or Jason on LinkedIn and say, hey, I have a new brand. I want you to know about it.
So do you now have a flat that's completely full of sample bottles of alcohol?
I do have a little bar in my apartment. I have way more than I can ever drink, nor will I ever drink. I'm very generous. I try to be generous with giving it away. We get a lot of samples, but I try to be respectful of brands when they say, can I send a sample? I'm like, you're welcome to, but in the spirit of trying to save you money, let's wait till we're a step down the diligence process before I actually make you spend money to send something to me.
And have you ever plucked one out of the samples and gone, yeah, I'd like to know more about this?
Sure. I mean, look, Grazzi was one of, when we first closed capital in early fall 2022, Grazzi was one of probably 30 to 40 brands that had offered to send samples just because they'd heard about us and they'd been introduced to us through one of our advisors. And in the early days, I was saying yes more than no, just because I wanted to get our feet wet, if you will, and start to build our initial funnel of opportunities and just kind of look at everything now that we actually had money to deploy. Grazzi tasted good, but that wasn't why we did the deal. We did the deal with Grazzi because of how remarkably compelling their initial numbers were. That was what got us over the edge. So the truth is, taste matters less to me than it probably does to other investors, largely because I think it's subjective.
I've heard so many people say that. So why do you think their numbers were good? What did they do right in a very competitive space that so many people are trying to get into? What did they do right that other people aren't doing?
The truth is, I don't know, right? To the point I was making, brand performance is largely much easier to diagnose when you've seen it work than it is to assume what's going to work in the future, right? Something about Grazzi's brand, their team, their value proposition, their messaging, their timing, and the way that Steven and his team have executed just hit right and has built an engine that has continued to compound. The metrics that got us the most excited early on were their retention numbers online, which meant that people who tried the product, we were at an order of magnitude higher than anyone else we'd seen, coming back and buying the product again and again and again. And so when we ran the numbers and looked at how their sales data was stacking up over time and projected it into the future at a very aggressive discount, the math worked that if they could even keep it up at a small fraction of the success they were having early on when they were only doing, you know, 100K a month or so in revenue, we knew this was going to be a big business. And luckily for us, our discounting and conservative projections ended up being way more conservative than they should have been, because the brand has just blown it out of the water since we invested.
If I was going to make a guess, knowing nothing about the brand or the team or whatsoever, I'd also say there's a timing issue there, because the alternative packaging has only just started to take off in the United States, the cans and the bag and box and so on.
Sure.
So, okay. So having looked at so many brands now, what are the ones that are dead in the water that when you look at, you just go, don't name names. I don't mean give me a name of anybody. I mean, give me the.
Conceptually. Yeah. What does it look like? Yeah. Look, the ones that are usually dead in the water are ones that have, very low pull through and velocity, right? So we give the example all the time. There's a very big difference between, let's just use $1 million in revenue as a framework and a benchmark. There's a very big difference between doing $1 million in revenue in New York and New Jersey concentrated versus doing $1 million of revenue in 14 states. Mm-hmm. And most brands, to get to $1 million in revenue, have to expand into 14 states to get that level of sales volume. And my, at least hypothesis, what I believe to be true from an investability perspective, is that you want to be doing as much revenue as possible in as small, as few accounts as possible, to make sure that as you expand, the revenue continues to build. But the ones that are dead in the water are the ones that are probably trying to service velocity that is dramatically below where it could or should be in a massive number of accounts that are expensive to maintain. Because if the product doesn't pull through at retail, back to our earlier conversation, if the product isn't pulling through at retail, you have to spend money to send people in there to keep the retailers happy enough to keep it on the shelves, which means that it's only going to pull through just enough to get the distributor to buy another round, which means it's really going to be hard to get your cash conversion cycle and your velocity numbers and your engine running efficiently enough to ever have any level of meaningful scale. So the ones that are way too widely distributed without enough pull through, in my opinion, who can't find a way, even as they get to scale, to break profit, that's a tough position to be in.
So I just want to unpack this a little bit. So in this case, are we talking about a product that just doesn't resell, or are we talking about a business strategy that isn't good, that they have gone out and got too many distributors over it? So it might not be the product that's a problem. It might be the business.
That is a very, very good question. I think the answer is it depends, right? There is precedent for businesses that were not moving well, that did have a good product, that with new management and the right incentive structure, new marketing, et cetera, fully turned it around, right? I think the example of High Noon is a good one, right? I believe that most large companies are quite bad at internal innovation. And I don't mean that to be offensive. I just think that that's the truth. And I think history would show that
that's why they have these investment arms.
Or M&A more effectively, I think, is really what their approach should be. But I think High Noon, as I understand it, was an internal launch that was not going well for a long time. It really wasn't working. And then they partnered with Dave Portnoy, who just had a remarkably loyal and engaged audience. And that was what turned the floodgates on of people wanting to try the product, right? So there is example and precedent of brands that are out there that just aren't working, where when you bring the right celebrity in, or you bring in a new team, or you refresh the packaging, you change distributors, you bring in a new incentive program for the retailers to make sure that they're, you know, feeling the love, et cetera, that can work. So the answer is it depends. I think generally the answer is probably that the product usually is just not resonating with customers at that time. It doesn't mean it can't, mm-hmm. but it would require a change. But there are examples sometimes of it's just not being merchandised right, or it's not showing the love, or the marketing is not dialed in.
Okay, let's talk about products at two ends of the market. One where the market is really saturated, like say tequila or gin in the UK, and one where there's hardly any innovation going on because people have forgotten about the category.
Yeah.
Are these things that you would still look at? Or if somebody's in those spaces, you'd go, no.
No, we would still look at it. It just, it becomes a part of our diligence process, right? Tequila, to use that example, it's very expensive to compete there. There's a huge market for it. And so tons of demand. And there's a big pie to grab a slice of. But to grab a slice of that pie is a very expensive proposition. The second part of that is that, you know, as an investor, I have to think about M&A cycles and what the portfolios look like of all the big manufacturers. I think a lot of manufacturers have at least enough bets in tequila for me to believe that it might be unrealistic that a tequila that starts now is going to sell at a good clip in the next 3 to 5 years. I think it could happen in the next 10 years, but I think right now a lot of the alpha in tequila might be priced in already. So for the growth stage brands, and really this boils down to like, how do they compete on the ground in the trenches? If you're a new tequila company and you want to launch in Texas or New York or California, there are so many other tequila companies that are either big and profitable or upstarter or new tequila companies that have been battling for months, if not years, to get on that menu, to get on that shelf, right? There's only so many tequilas that can exist in an ecosystem before the customer is like, okay, I get it. And so I think tequila right now probably needs to shake itself out over the next few years. That doesn't mean there's not opportunity in the space. There's a lot of good brands that have launched recently, and there are absolutely pockets of alpha in the tequila space, but it's a harder and more expensive proposition to play there. So that's not saying we wouldn't fund a tequila. We absolutely would be open to it. It just comes into how we think about the diligence and underwriting.
So how many fundings or how many products have you invested in so far?
Out of fund one, we did 6 total deals, 5 brands, 1 special situations investment. Fund two will be higher. We'll probably be closer to 20 or 25 investments in fund two. We've already made our first and we'll likely close on our second two within the next 2 weeks. So it's exciting.
What's a special situations investment?
Distressed bankruptcy type of things that are not traditional growth equity investments or seed stage
investments.
Okay,
so without, again, telling me what it is, if you don't want to, but what made you go for a distressed brand?
My job is to make my investors money, and I saw an opportunity to do so. And so we pulled a team in to execute a playbook on an opportunity we thought was compelling. You know, we have a sort of carve out within our fund strategy that says we can and should look for unique opportunities like that if we see a good path to making money. And it worked in fund one, so we did it.
Okay, again, without telling me the thing, is it that you thought the product was great and the business strategy sucked? Was it that kind of situation?
No, it was actually more so that we saw a unique dislocation between a set of products and a capital structure that needed creative problem solving. And we saw an opportunity to come in, insert ourselves, and really solve a problem for everybody involved in a uniquely distressed deal.
Okay. Now, a lot of people try and launch products online, that they're DTC products.
Yep.
It's really interesting. So I just did a story about people trying to sell wineries. And for years and years and years, people have been told they need to build their DTC channel. And it turns out if you want to sell a winery, a DTC only channel sucks, that you actually need to have distribution because you can't scale up if you don't have distribution.
Right.
So this is my long-winded way of saying, if you have a DTC brand and it's successful at that level, should you keep it or should you always be looking for distribution at some point?
Great question. I think that's what you said about you need to have a wholesale business because it's so much more effective for how big companies will think about M&A. I think that's true in this market. I have a feeling that that might flip back. Like 5 years ago, D2C was all the rage, right? And they were getting priced at very high multiples. So I think it's just a matter of what market cycle we're in. I can give you the example of Grazzi. Mm-hmm. When we invested in Grazzi, they were D2C only. And they have an incredible D2C business that will do over $20 million in revenue this year. But as a part of our investment into Grazzi, we told Steven, the founder, that it was going to be mission critical for him to have at the very least, growing and initially successful wholesale business to make sure that this business was not only acquirable, but had the foundation to scale, whether or not he ever wants to sell the business. So he started D2C only and then launched in 2022 into wholesale retail, and the business has been growing dramatically because they built a good team around that. So I think the answer is, in this market, you can and should have both. I do have a strong feeling that in the next 5 years, the large wine players will realize that well-run D2C businesses can be really good, lucrative businesses in parts of their portfolio. So I think that might flip back. I just think in this M&A cycle, the markets aren't really pricing it as high as they are a good wholesale business. So it just depends on what cycle we're in.
Okay, let's talk about how the investment works. Just say that I have created a cream liqueur brand because I like them, and it's an area that is, I think, ripe for disruption, yeah, and you're interested in it. What's the process? Do you take, do you now own part of it, or do you give me business help, or do you just give me investment so I can go and fulfill my business plan? What, how does it work?
Yeah, we generally do traditional equity investments. So we like to lead equity rounds. We usually do that as a traditional price equity round where we're leading a funding round, taking a board seat. There's often other investors coming in alongside us to participate. And, you know, so we're trading dollars for equity in the business that the fund now owns. And as either board members or try to be active supportive investors, we're trying to figure out every place we can help them accelerate, even if that means staying out of their way, right? Sometimes brands do just need money because everything's working and they're hamstrung by the fact that they don't have enough capital. And so we try to say that, look, top shelf's value outside of just our money is that the name top shelf, if you bring that to a distributor, a retailer, or to corporate teams, they should hopefully, at least if they don't, soon know who we are. And that should hold some level of weight. And more importantly, if there's something that they need, whether it's introductions to retail, intros to distributors, hiring, well, the whole nine yards, we can help. But it's traditional equity investing for the most part.
Okay, so the spirits space particularly often attracts people who are very romantic, very artisanal. They're doing what they're doing because they just absolutely love it. And those people can sometimes be very, very successful, but they're not always very good business people.
Right.
So would you invest in somebody like that, or would you, or is it really critical to you that you have somebody that can hit KPIs and do the Excel spreadsheets and so on?
I think there's, I don't know that I would say that the Excel spreadsheet is the right proxy. I think people need to know how to run a business, right? It is hard to imagine that somebody will be able to really get to where they need to go if they have no one around them that can at least run the business somewhat properly. You know, of course, there are exceptions to this in any industry where you kind of just hold on for dear life and don't run it well, and eventually things work out. I think that's the exception, not the norm. So yeah. We have tons of affinity and respect for people who are such artisans and can be brilliant creatives and create things out of nothing. And the alchemy of creating a new brand is really magic. And I respect that. But I do think you either yourself or have to have someone around you who can be some level of a good operator to make sure that the trains run on time. I think that's important. In alcohol and really any venture ecosystem.
Okay, now we get to the heart of why I wanted to speak to you. So a lot of people in beverage alcohol are feeling pretty miserable at the moment as sales go down, except for RTDs.
Yep.
And I saw you on LinkedIn doing a post about, you said it's the best time ever to invest in alcohol. So cheer up the industry. Why do you think it's a great time to invest in alcohol?
Here's my hot take that I hope doesn't sound too hot to everybody. I believe that the actual thing that's going on is that we as an industry have been spoiled by 50 straight years of year-over-year growth, where the only thing we know is that it's going to be better next year than it was the year prior. And then COVID happens and everybody starts drinking like fish, right? Everything is at an all-time high production. And so people are drinking more. So retailers buy more. So distributors buy more. So manufacturers need to make more. So production goes up. And because our precedent was taking last year's numbers and extrapolating that we were going to grow the following year, everybody started producing like crazy, assuming that the COVID trends were going to continue. And sure enough, like any black swan moment, they don't continue. They reset to normal. So consumers, after being locked inside, start going back outside, realize, hey, maybe I shouldn't be having this much alcohol. Maybe I should go back to some more normal, or maybe cut back my drinking a little bit just to reset the system. And so you've got this mismatch where the booze industry, who's been spoiled by year-over-year growth forever, basically, has now been hit with the reality that customers have stepped down from where they were when they were trapped at home during the pandemic. And so they've reset. So now the booze industry has this glut. Consumers are just drinking back to normal. I still think things are generally better than they were in 2019. If you remove the black swan moment of COVID, I think things would have continued to grow incrementally like they do every single year. So when I take all that into account, I fundamentally believe people will continue to drink alcohol. I think that the nonsense articles about drinking is going away and all that, I think that's mostly nonsense. So well, I think it's a good time.
Let me just challenge that a little bit. I mean, there has been an avalanche of information about there's no safe level of alcohol and alcohol's going to give you cancer. We know that younger people of legal drinking age are not drinking the way their predecessors, the way certainly my generation did. We also know that you have to sort of develop a relationship with it or you won't take it up later. I mean, all of these things are hitting the alcohol business. So I know it's always, people should say this time it's different, it's never different. But there is a feeling that this time it is different because of all of the health and wellness trends. What's your response to that?
My response is that there's merit to some of that. And I think there may be compressions and contractions and then expansions in the industry cyclical. But as I understand it, and granted, I was not alive nor certainly not investing at this time, there was a massive drop off in drinking in the 80s too, when the health movement and the Jane Fonda movement and all that hit the industry at once, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. There was a massive avalanche at that moment of people saying, don't drink alcohol. And I spoke to one of the presidents of one of the largest distributorships who reflected that in that time, things dropped 20 to 30% over a few years of dramatic, dramatic fall off in drinking because Mothers Against Drunk Driving had massive campaigns that alcohol was bad and Jane Fonda was the hot thing of the day and everyone wanted to be healthy. And so things were compressed in the booze business. It shrunk. And then in the 1990s, it was back to all-time highs. Here's my real fundamental punchline of why I think we as an industry, the booze industry, needs to be aware of this. I think you need to make moves accordingly to try to reposition and understand what it is that's not landing from a messaging perspective. My fundamental belief is that humans, no matter what the science or zeitgeist, et cetera, says, are going to crave escapism and they're going to crave human connection forever. And alcohol is the one vice business that has stood the test of time for hundreds of years that humans have proven that they will continue to go back to it and crave it. And so until there is another industry that is as commercially available, societally accepted, and ubiquitous as booze that can solve for that human connection the same way alcohol can, I don't think there's a systemic threat. Will there be ebbs and flows in how these things go? For sure, there should be. That's the nature of any industry, especially one that's this mature. Is it systemically going to go away? Absolutely not.
You know, there's hundreds of people weeping in gratitude listening to you just say that right now.
Yeah, okay. Look, I think it's... I just want to double click on that because I do think it's important. I am well aware that I sit in a luxurious position of my business. I do not own a legacy wine manufacturer that is seeing myself. I understand that it's easier for me to sit here and say it from this perspective. So the best thing that I can do is just tell you how I see it as a 29-year-old consumer who watches both how my friends and my circles behave and how the rest of the industry behaves. There is a lot of attention in the news. There's a lot of excitement on Twitter about saunas and run clubs and cold plunges and measuring your sleep and all that stuff. I honestly think it is just a trend that, like most trends, will fall back to some level of normalcy, right? Drinking and connecting over a beverage is a thing that has been around for hundreds, if not thousands of years. Most of my friends that said a year ago, we're going to stop drinking forever, have now come back to what I believe is the right amount of drinking, which is socially, on occasion, a couple times a week, as a mechanism to connect with friends and enjoy life. I think that's why this industry works. That's why many of us do and behave the way we do in this industry, is because it is a beautiful business built around a core human need. You have to be careful with it. There's plenty of issues. You have to tread lightly, and all the things that we do as an industry to make sure we behave responsibly are critically important. But I genuinely do not see a world where drinking goes away. And if by some miracle, if by some miracle there comes a time when the alcohol industry has actually subsided and people aren't drinking alcohol anymore, they will have unequivocally replaced it with something else that they are consuming that is probably a vice that is giving them that same level of social connection. And so my intent as an investor and someone who I intend to shepherd in the next generation of amazing brands and businesses in this space is that even if it's not booze, the incredible infrastructure that the booze industry has that does trillions of dollars of value per year in trade needs to shepherd in whatever that next thing is going to be too. So I think our infrastructure, our business, as long as we are being aware of where things are going, and it should be just fine for those who can keep up.
Excellent. Right. Which brings me to my next question. Sure. Non-alc, what's your view about that?
Depends on what kind. Non-alc beer, fairly interesting. Non-alc wine, I don't totally understand it. Non-alc spirits, not very bullish. THC, functional things.
Let's talk about spirits. The thing with beer is that you can ferment beer to dryness and it's still beer. So even if it doesn't have alcohol in it, it's mm-hmm. fine. It's a perfect substitute. Now, that's not true of the other alcohols. Yeah. Wine, all you can do is de-alcoholize it and it's kind of an abomination. Spirits is a different thing because you can, well, it is, and it's environmentally disastrous because it releases so much greenhouse gas in the process. Spirits are a completely different thing because you can find substitutes for heat and the burn and whatever, but they tend to be expensive. So what do you think is their future?
My instinct is that the absolute best case scenario end state for non-alc wine or non-alc spirits and non-alc beer included is that it is a very, very small fraction of the overall market designed to serve a very specific type of customer. It has a place on menus and in stores, but it's a very, very small fraction, right? I don't have anything against the industry per se. I just think, you know, the businesses that I'm seeing in this space are attempting to sell a story and therefore price their business investment proposition in a way that would indicate it's going to be a genuine challenger to alcohol in terms of the volume and revenue and place that serves in society. I think that's mostly nonsense. For non-alc beer included, Athletic Brewing is an incredible business. I met the founding team. Incredible people, incredible entrepreneurs. What they built is remarkable. And I think there's room for more businesses like that that basically become something of like a soda. It's more of a soda occasion than it is a beer occasion because it's solving a different problem. I think having an Athletic Brew with friends is very cool. I've drank it and, you know, I do a lot of triathlons and races. I like to have an Athletic Brew when I finish the race. I also like a Blue Moon or a Bud Light, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, it just solves a different purpose. So I think the future state of those industries is that they have a small percentage of the total share of, you know, a bar or restaurant or liquor store's shelf space. And I think that they serve a consumer who has the interest in a certain occasion or two to try that. But I think it's a fraction of the bigger market.
Okay, next one. The next thing that we've seen in the last few years is a trend across all alcohol towards premiumization, that people are getting rid of the cheaper brands and so on. And now inflation bites, the luxury market is dropping, premiumization is dropping. What do you think the long-term trend of that is?
I think it's pretty tied to where the economy is, honestly. Like the big, you know, we've talked a lot about in this already, the effects of COVID on the industry. I think that had a really big effect on premiumization as well. A lot of people got stimulus checks during COVID. And so they had discretionary money. And instead of buying a $40 bottle of tequila, the 1942 looked a little more exciting because they actually had some money to spend on it. And that's a very specific anecdotal example, but I think that's indicative of really what happens where people want their booze and it depends on what cycle they're in terms of how they're going to drink it. So I think it's always going to flip back and forth. And I think that the big manufacturers are just going to need to be on their toes around what is happening in the market.
Okay. Another of the great things you said on LinkedIn, I love your LinkedIn content, actually. It's fantastic.
Oh, thank you. I'll try to keep it up.
You do have to keep it up, yeah, and I'm going to make everybody follow you just to put the pressure on it. Okay, so you've talked about the need for a killer sampling strategy. Can you talk about that and just go for it?
Sure. Liquid to lips. I have to give credit to Uncle Mike for pounding this phrase into my head. Liquid to lips is a hero strategy for how you build, scale, and grow any brand. The reason for that is that when a customer has been able to try your product, it can have sort of one of the most material impacts on their willingness and excitement, not only to buy it, but come back and buy it again. Trial drives purchase, which drives repeat purchase if the product is good. The dirty little secret of booze and this industry, really any CPG product, right? Booze aside, any CPG product is that a lot of it comes down to like, how do you have to like the taste, but how do you feel? What does the story mean to you? How does it resonate with you? Right. You know, as well as I do that in the wine business, wine is subjective, right? Mm. If you say you like a wine, you're right. Whether it's a two-buck chuck or a Chateauneuf de Pape or a Screaming Eagle, if you like it, you're not wrong. And so the ability of a tasting experience to make you feel something is pretty important. And I've also said before, you know, I've given the example, would you rather have a beautiful display of a tasting booth, like really nice. Let's just say we have a brand called Sunboy in our portfolio. And would I rather have Sunboy have the most beautiful coconut tropical display with sand and all this amazing stuff that when someone walks up, like, this is cool, or just have Yair, who's the founder, who is an unbelievable salesman that gets anyone excited at an ugly booth, right? Would I rather have a beautiful booth with a terrible salesperson or just a killer salesperson, ugly booth? You'd rather have a killer salesperson because their ability to talk to you and get you excited, if they are actually good, they're going to forget where they are. They're going to forget about the coconuts and the palm trees around. They're going to forget the environment. They're just going to be focused on why should they be excited. So you need a good storyteller, right? I would rather have Yair 10 out of 10 times in the worst tasting environment ever than a beautiful, really expensive display with a terrible, uncharismatic person 10 out of 10 times, because Yair can sell the product and the story himself, right? And so a good tasting strategy, it's hard to do because you have to train someone on good salesmanship. You have to train someone on why they should get the product. You have to train someone on how to get someone to stop what they're doing, stop their journey to go find the one thing they came in there for and try yours, right? So a good sampling strategy, if done well, can be not only efficient, but super profitable, right? Grazzi is another example. There's examples of some of their best tasters will consistently move like 20 to 30 boxes of wine in a 2-hour tasting, which that's 4 bottles per box. So you can do the math. That's a lot of wine to sell in 2 hours, right? That's more wine than some brands will sell in a month. And they do it in 2 hours because they have a good taster. They're doing it.
Can you break that down? What is it that they're doing? Is it their personal enthusiasm? Is it their story? Like, what is it that they're doing that works that other people aren't doing?
I think, look, you have to have a good enough product that's going to get people compelled to care once they try it. But assuming you have that, which anyone running a tasting should have, it's a mix between how are they telling the story? How are they communicating the value prop? And how are they engaging with the customer, right? Good salesmanship is good conversation, right? And so a lot of this is like a lot of Grazzi's customers, a lot of Sunboy's initial customers, they become loyalists because they meet and the initial experience with the brand, they meet the person serving it and they said, that felt good. I liked that, right? They asked me about my day. They told me about why the product is. They connected me back to the founder. They were the founder and they made it a personal experience. So what are they doing? They're trying to get people to stop. They're stopping people along the way. They're respectfully engaging in conversation. They're giving a compelling pitch about why the product matters. You mix that all together. And if you can get, you know, 1 out of every 5 people to stop, or if you're really good, 1 of every 3 people to stop, half those people might buy or a third of those people might buy, you can move some volume.
Right. Now, your final LinkedIn observation, which I really liked, is you recently wrote a post about consumers turning away from legacy brands. Mm. What opportunities and pitfalls does this present to entrepreneurs trying to build a challenger brand?
Well, I think it's more opportunity than pitfall. I think it's an interesting moment. Right, I think that fundamentally consumers still want to drink. And I think that largely the large brands that are household names, with exception, but a lot of them just quite simply hold less weight and relevance in the eyes of consumers than they did even 5 years ago, right? Where the brands that used to really matter, where consumers were super loyal to that, they're a little more open-minded to something new, right? I've seen it even in my ecosystem of friends where people who were loyalists to Tito's, they would not drink anything else, are now like, oh, I tried this new vodka the other day. It's actually pretty interesting, where they're open to new things. And that represents both a threat and opportunity because the truth is that those consumers are still drinking. They're still drinking, for example, vodka. They still like Tito's. And they have nothing against Tito's. They're just a little more curious than they were a while ago. And perhaps the Tito's name holds a little bit less weight.
Do you know why you're watching people doing that? Is it because, is that across their whole purchasing behaviors? Is that the same with clothes and food as well? Or is it just alcohol?
I think it's actually across most CPG categories, right? There was the thing that prompted me to make that post was actually an article about how Kraft mac and cheese is feeling the effects of new challenger brands where Kraft mac and cheese, for a long time, mac and cheese, you just thought Kraft. That was the answer, full stop. That was what you wanted to buy because they were the brand in town. And now there's some other brands that have come in with either compelling value props or just refreshing new ideas that are getting consumers either to trade into mac and cheese or trade out of Kraft because they're just curious and excited. And that's a proxy for the notion that consumers will, at a certain point, perhaps go through cycles of how they think about legacy brands. This happens in any industry, right? Brands ride big waves, they become household names, then they lose a little bit of relevance. If the ownership company of that brand is smart, they'll be acquiring other brands to bolster their portfolio along the way. And then eventually there's the nostalgia where brands that used to hold relevance can be traded back in and blow up again, right? That's a tale as old as time.
All right. I want to talk in a moment about Uncharted, but before I do, final question about brands and new brands and investment. Where do you see the big opportunity right now?
I'm agnostic to category. You know, like I said, we have certain trends that we're excited about. I think there's room for vodka, new vodkas in the space. I think beer actually has some room for new players in the space. I think there hasn't been a new exciting rum brand in a while. I think spirits-based RTDs are remarkably exciting. Alternative packaging is exciting. I think pre-bottled cocktails are exciting. I think there's unique plays within existing large categories, right? I think there's plays to be, you know, the Well vodka, the Well tequila, the Well gin, I think, is an underpriced asset in a lot of bars and restaurants where we got a pitch deck the other day for a company that is focused explicitly on being the bartender's favorite premium Well drink. That's a really exciting proposition because if it's the Well drink, it's going to move like crazy, right? And if bartenders like it, that's exciting, right?
And how do you get in that position? Is it that you make sure that the bottle is easy to grab? I mean, what's the way of becoming the bartender's favorite?
That tends to be a route to market question. And the ones that are best at that usually have either existing relationships or some strategy of how they're going to get that part of the trade to care. That's something that is, you know, you can coach it, but that usually happens because somebody has spent years in the industry or started there or had some unique insight about how to get people to care or is just relentless at execution. But I think, look, I love the example of Beatbox because Beatbox and Grazzi, I think, are two of the most important businesses in the ecosystem of alcohol right now. Beatbox has basically created a new category where it's wine-based, but it's kind of a cocktail, but it's also kind of a seltzer. It's sold in a Tetra Pak, and consumers are drinking it in ways no one in the industry would have thought possible.
Yeah.
Similarly, Grazzi, nobody would have thought people were spending $40 or $50 on a premium box of wine 3 years ago. And here they are. So I think they're important trends.
Yeah. Okay. So you're in your 20s and yet you've put together a community with Uncharted where you bring really big people together in a room to speak to each other without anybody recording it and swapping business ideas. Tell me about that.
It started as an accident. I mentioned, I think before we started the interview, that Michael Loeb is a big figure in my life. He's a friend first and foremost, but he's a mentor. He's a business partner. He's been very influential on me. And he and I, after COVID was starting to subside, started hosting a dinner series at his townhouse on the Upper East Side. And that dinner series was basically us just bringing together our most impressive friends. For me, that was tended to be the up and coming entrepreneurs, new fund managers, founders who had built a business and maybe just sold it, were looking for the next thing. And Michael, obviously, with his stature and what he's done, he has some very successful friends that are often looking to meet the up and coming generation. And we mixed those two things together. We came up with a unique framework for how we were going to moderate it, where he and I kind of ham and egged and we co-hosted together. I moderated, but we tag teamed it. And that framework got so much traction that we've built a business around scaling that dinner series into a community of amazing founders and funders that activates through dinners and summits, mostly in New York, but now SF, LA, and beyond.
And is it just people socializing, or through that process, are people doing business and coming up with new ideas?
First, socializing very quickly into trading ideas and eventually into doing business. There's tens of millions of dollars of deals that have gotten done through Uncharted that we know about.
Okay. Final question. When you're not doing all of this, what do you drink?
In order, my preference tends to go red wine, mezcal, tequila, whiskey. But I'm agnostic. I try not to discriminate, if you will.
All right. On that note, thank you very much for your time, Noah.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome.